Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Finn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Scott Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's the Need to Know podcast, all thanks to Rode Microphones. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, NGK Podcast, and online at podcasts.needtoknow.cloud.
Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast. This is episode 182, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Brenton Johnson. Welcome, Brenton.
G'day, Robert. Good to be back.
So we're getting towards the end of the financial year here in Australia, which means panic time for many businesses trying to get everything in and under budget. So people should be throwing money at you. Is that the case, Brenton?
Oh, I've got a little bit of money getting thrown at me, but no one's gone stupid yet. I did get a proposal come in this week that was for quite a big on-premises deployment. So I'm having a look at it, and I said, I don't know if this is really the best solution for you guys. Would you be open to coming out and having a full cloud discussion? They said, yeah, like, we don't think that's possible, but we might think it's, we'll give you a go at it. I said, okay. So I'll go out there and explain to them the many benefits of moving to full cloud. And, even if they don't move everything to cloud, that they move some of this stuff to cloud, so they don't have to buy it all up front. Because that's the old model, isn't it, Robert? Go and buy, a 100-seater bus when you've only got two passengers, and then hopefully by the time you need to retire the bus, you haven't filled up all the seats yet.
Well, I think, again, part of it is that in this day and age, it's really hard to spec out software for a period of time because needs change and they could go up, they could go down. And, again, adding all this stuff and, thinking that this is how it's going to turn out can end up being very expensive. It's underutilized for a lot of the time. And, again, you can end up in a situation where things change and that you don't need it anymore, but you're stuck with it because you've got to buy it up front. So just got to be very careful. I think one of the benefits of something like Azure in replacing on-prem environments is typically the ability to scale and underspec to start off with and then just add more stuff as you need it down the track. And a lot of this stuff, I think, can be done directly in the cloud using, something like Azure to replace the infrastructure. Hooked to Office 365, I think that's a really good solution. But many cases, it's not for everybody, but that's less and less the case, I think, these days. So I certainly would have encouraged people to have a look at the solution, what could be done. But for a lot of people, they like to default to on-prem environments, which means, unfortunately, a big upfront cost.
Yeah, and that is how it is. And I think customers are used to buying that way. But the sort of more agile, born in the cloud customers that I'm coming across, if I went to them and said you got to spend $30,000 on a box, they'd throw me out of the thing. But if you say, it's going to be $500 a month, they go, is that all? Because they're so used to buying everything on a month-to-month basis. So it's a matter of bringing these people along and saying, okay, well, in the past you used to go buy this box, and it was really, really expensive. And you go, okay, we'll move it into cloud. It might be 80% of the cost, or it might be 120% of the cost, or it might be 200% of the cost. It doesn't really matter, because what we're trying to get to at the end of the day is an ROI. So if we can get it in the cloud and automate it, and, three staff don't need to come to work every day, we redeploy those staff into revenue-generating activities, all of a sudden you've got a technological advantage rather than a technological cost, which is pretty much all the on-prem stuff is now. It's you're carrying technical debt. You preach it as much as anyone, Robert.
Well, I think the reality here is the big thing is maybe not so much the cost, it's the flexibility. I think that on-prem, people wanting to run virtual machines and you need a huge amount of RAM, a huge amount of disk space, and if, when, maybe, possibly, and there's never enough, you're always going to run out of it. That's where something like, Azure can give you that scalability, add the disks, you can add more servers temporarily, and you just pay for what you use. So billing by the second, as you can with Azure, is going to give you a huge amount more flexibility, and it's going to give you that ability to, rather than putting everything on a single server with lots of RAM, you could break it across multiple servers. You could scale them up and down as you required. You've got more flexibility, the ability, again, for, I think, for DR as well. But as you say, it's some people are still prefer the old way, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. But I think at the end of the day, they're going to end up, it's going to end up costing them more, because the flexibility is really what's required, I think, moving forward. So, go and talk to them, see what they say. And I think that keep in touch with them, and then offer, obviously, the flexibility if they need it, because I think that's really what they're going to be after down the track.
Yeah, I think so. And if they are a fast-growing business, an agile business, they're in software development, I'll be able to talk to them about DevOps and all of that sort of stuff. And if they understand that sort of language, which they should if they're doing software development, then all of this will just be second nature to them. But, you know, if it is the old traditional software house, you go in, sell 500 licenses and whatever, then it's a completely different conversation, isn't it? And, you know, maybe not a conversation I want to have.
Exactly. All right, so we need to keep this moving along, because we do have a bit of a special episode. We're letting Brenton fly solo for the first time. So why don't you give us a bit of an intro before we get into the full-blown interview as to what we're likely to hear, Brenton?
Yeah, so this week I wanted to talk about customer experience. So we do a lot on Office 365, and one of the biggest advantages of Office 365 is that consistent customer experience. You go into Outlook Online, you go to Teams, you go to Planner, you go to SharePoint. Everything looks familiar, and there's a consistent customer experience. So people can very easily, who have, you know, never used this app before, it looks familiar to them and they can get around. So that's one of the real strengths of the Office 365 cloud services in particular. So we're going to talk about, well, what is customer experience in IT? How should you be selling that to your customer? How's your own customer experience work? I think it'll be an interesting one. And Josh used to work and do consulting with me in my business a while ago, but now he's moved on to bigger and better things, which I don't know if I can talk about yet. But let's just say he's found a role that's very, very in sync with his capability. So I think that'll be a good one for everybody, and I'd love to hear some discussion around it too, if anyone wants to send me messages at feedback@needtoknow.cloud.
Excellent. Well, speaking of feedback from Need to Know Cloud, we did get something in this week from one of the listeners. But before we jump to that, how about we just bring people up to the news and what's happening. So one of the big things that happened in the last week was the SharePoint conference in Las Vegas. It was also mirrored by a SharePoint virtual summit, which you can attend still now and look at some of the replays. So some of the new stuff that SharePoint is bringing us is a lot of improvements around OneDrive for Business. So one of the things that they're adding, which has been very high on a lot of people's lists, is the ability to upload photos directly from the OneDrive mobile app directly into OneDrive for Business. You could do this in the consumer version, and now you can do it in the business version as well. So I think that's going to be a big positive for a lot of people. Shows the direction and obviously the commitment Microsoft's making to the to the platform. Now, in the SharePoint space, what they did is they've also let us know that the file viewer for document libraries will appear in Teams. So at the moment, Teams is a bit of a summary of what's actually in the document library. You can't see some of the metadata. You can't see the additional columns you've created and the formatting. Well, guess what? They're now going to update the Teams ability to show the full document library. So we're going to basically have the full SharePoint document library experience when we go to the Files tab inside our Teams app, whether that's on the desktop or on the web. We're also going to be able to see which channels are connected to our SharePoint document libraries. So that'll let us know when certain things have been connected to Teams. And we're also going to see a bigger focus on the news articles that bubble up through SharePoint. And there's also already a connector in Teams that allows you to show that. So again, all in all, a lot of improvements there. We're also getting some new Planner integrations into SharePoint. We're also getting the ability to move to SharePoint Server 2019 on-prem. So Microsoft isn't going to kill off SharePoint 2019 on-prem, but it will bring it out in beta early next year for people who are still in the on-prem world. It's going to have a more connected environment to Office 365 and that. But the way to think about it is that when 2019 on-prem comes out, there'll be a snapshot in time. The online version will continue to march forward. And then obviously the on-prem people can get updates as Microsoft pushes them out. So you're always going to get the latest stuff using the online version rather than the on-prem, but it's interesting that they are basically staying on on-prem. So again, lots of features.
Yeah, why do you think that is, Robert? Why do you think Microsoft's decided to continue to support SharePoint on-prem?
Well, I think the reality is that, as we've talked about, a lot of people are still on-prem focused, especially some of the larger businesses. They've made significant investments. They have integrations that may not be supported in the cloud. They may have custom software. They may have custom branding. And I think that there are still some people who like to run their own environment, who obviously have a large team and they're spending lots of money in the SharePoint space doing it. It's not quite the same thing as email, which is sort of a lift and a shift to an extent. I think SharePoint's got a lot more content, a lot more blood, sweat and tears in it. So I think for the time being, that's the way Microsoft's going to go. But again, this is still a very big gap between the previous version. So I would suggest that, again, it's still going to be the best option moving to the cloud. But there are still going to be some businesses that do want to stay on-prem and think that that's a better option. So they will get all the latest features up to a point. But I think the smaller you are, the less likely you are to be running SharePoint on-prem anymore.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it is those big companies that have built their AMS on the back of it. Not AMS, you know, I'm talking about line of business application on the back of SharePoint and are now struggling to get it up in the cloud. And Microsoft's going, oh, we don't want them to be like on Windows 7 forever. We want them to be on a reasonably new version that starts getting their data ready for that cloud migration.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that Microsoft, again, is still committed, is probably the best organization to do the hybrid environment. They recognize that a lot of people still are making a transition to the cloud. This is obviously another way for them to help them do that. And it may be a case, for example, where maybe you want to index or search your on-prem environment as well as in the cloud. You're going to need a SharePoint 2019 on-prem to do that hybrid arrangement, so people in the cloud can search on-prem all through the same sort of gateway. So there are very good reasons for it, but it's typically going to be at the large end of town, I think. So again, we'll put the links the updates and the things that Microsoft's added. One of the other interesting things that I saw is that Microsoft's coming out with this new thing called Microsoft Training Services. So think of this like a portal or a training portal you can embed or upload or put into your Office 365 SharePoint environment that will have a whole range of training. So the idea here is Microsoft will have videos, which has all the content. They will push that through this option here, allow you to customize the look and the feel and things like that. But they will make sure all the content is up to date and comes directly from Microsoft. So at the moment, that's a beta sign up at this stage, and it looks as though it's going to go in pilot in July with a rollout later in the year. So there's a lot of call, I think, out there for people looking for training, how to keep up to date, and having it pushed, I think, directly from Microsoft is probably a very good option, don't you think?
Oh, look, I couldn't agree more. And particularly, this is going to be a boon for the small business. So a lot of the stuff that we talk about in Office 365 really benefits the enterprise most. I think this is one that you could go out with an offering and, you know, you're struggling to get customers to get on. You're a 5-10 seat customer. To go and do an actual proper cloud rollout, you know, and explain to them how it all works together and do the cultural shift and all of that sort of thing, it's going to be a huge amount of effort and a huge amount of expense for the customer. It's not something they're going to understand the value of until they've done it. So this way you can go, okay, well, let's start with your own personal productivity. Here's OneNote, here's Planner. Just use those two apps. Here's some videos on it, and off they go, which is, you know, here's Windows 10, here's the thing in Windows 10, go off, do that. So I think that's going to be just an amazing boon for small businesses. But I wonder if it'll be like everything else in Office 365, Robert, deeply neglected by everybody.
Well, I think the thing will be interesting to see. I've certainly signed up for the trial and be very keen to have a look at it. I mean, I do a lot of training and content creation myself, and if that alleviates some of it, I think it will be very general in case it's worth looking at. But we'll just have to wait and see how difficult it is to deploy and actually what the content. Microsoft's had a couple of goes at this previously, so we'll have to just wait and see what comes out. But I think, again, it's a case of knowing it's available. I don't think that, again, like you said, a lot of people will be aware that it is. So hopefully getting the word out on our podcast will at least let a few people know that they should have a look at it and maybe think about integrating it into their environment. Now, we also had the Build conference. So that was aimed at developers, but there are some very interesting things around things like AI and Azure that came out of that Build conference. Now, we'll put up a link to a list there so you can explore the Build content by playlist. So they're all broken down by different areas. So if you want to get into that, there's some great stuff to go and have a look at and understand Microsoft's direction and what it's actually deploying. One of the really cool things that we saw was a connected office where you walked in to have a meeting, the machines recognize you, and if you said that you were going to do a task, they then added that task to your calendar, added it to a general list. So we're seeing this sort of intelligence being integrated more and more into daily business life, and that's certainly going to make things a lot easier, I think. So that's pretty cool. Some other quick things on Azure. There's an updated version of the Azure Storage Explorer, so this allows you to look at your blobs, your VHDs, all that sort of stuff directly using a little piece of software. So that has been updated. Have a look at that. We'll put the links in there. There's also a preview of the Azure AD authentication for storage. So storage in Azure is pretty much a PaaS service. Microsoft looks after the underlying hardware that makes it happen. Now, connecting that to your virtual network, connecting that to virtual machines, linking that to Azure AD is going to be much easier now that the storage will automatically support that authentication as well. That's in preview. I'll put a link in there for you to go and have a look at. One other thing here in Azure is that there will be changes to the Azure Cloud Shell. So Azure Cloud Shell allows you to push a button in your Azure console. It will then launch a PowerShell console automatically, log you in, put in all the appropriate modules so you can do your PowerShell in Azure. Now, for those of you who don't know, PowerShell has been ceased on Windows at version 5.1, I think, from memory, and it's now moving to version 6. Now, the big difference with version 6 is, Britton, do you know what the difference between version 5 and version 6
is? Yes, cross-platform support, Robert.
Open source, so, basically. Yeah, exactly.
It
so,
will run on Linux, it will run on Mac, it will run in the web browser.
So basically what we're seeing is the Azure Cloud Shell is moving to being version 6, which as Britton clearly demonstrates, it's going to be open source. So some of the modules that we see today in Windows won't yet be available. They will be coming very shortly. But again, if you're not into PowerShell, you really need to be. And just be aware that the shell, the Cloud Shell, is moving to version 6. Now, the other one that I saved for last here is an Office 365 one. I don't know if you've seen this, Britton, but I think this could cause a bit of consternation for a few people out there who look after IT systems. Microsoft is going to provide from June, I believe, a free one-year trial of Microsoft Teams automatically into Office 365 environments, as well as people who don't have Office 365 as yet. So there's an interesting way to get more people to use Teams, isn't it?
Well, I think it will be interesting. So if it works like how Teams works today, essentially a customer will sign up, it will provision an Office 365 tenant, then it will provision an Azure tenant and an Azure AD environment, and then it will go off, and when you put a document in there, it'll store some of the documents in SharePoint, it will have some in OneNote, and it will have it keeps conversation history in Exchange. And then the customer will come to you and go, oh yeah, we've been using this for 6 months or something, why isn't it working properly? And then they'll go, oh well, because we've been licensing, been running your email out of a different one. I think it'll be interesting. I think it'll be a true test of how close you are to your customers, and Yeah,
well, I think it's also going to be very interesting that a lot of people are going to suddenly get notifications that they should be using Teams. So that's going to start popping up. Now, there is the ability to turn that off, that trial off in the admin console, but obviously it's going to be on by default. So if you do not want your users to be notified about a free 1 year use of Teams or to be solicited to start using it, I would suggest you need to go into the admin console quick smart and make sure that you turn that off when that becomes available. Otherwise, they're likely to, as Brenton mentioned, start clicking buttons and making things happen, which again could cause a bit of consternation and a bit of issues if you are not on top of your customer environment. Now,
there'll be a nice little $30 PowerShell script on Robert's website when it comes out, if you want to turn it off for everybody.
We'll come to that in a minute. But one last thing, which I overlooked, which we can't overlook, the GDPR is now here. It is now in force. So did you see the amount of claims or lawsuits that were launched on the very first day?
Yeah, I saw that the big tech giants were targeted, but it was to be expected, I think. People are pretty sick to death with how big corporates have been managing their information. So, it's an interesting one. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. It's still very early days. I think it's going to be a bit of a benchmark for how we're going to see compliance done going forward. So if you aren't across GDPR, make sure you are. Keep an eye on it because we're seeing more and more regulation around our environment and around IT and people's personal information. So, again, it's a very important, becoming a more important thing now with IT. What about you, Brenton? Anything at your end?
Probably just one thing that I set up this week. I found a free DMARC tool, and Robert will put the links in the description there from Postmark. Essentially, when you set up your DMARC record, you can choose to put in your email address for reporting. This is great. It puts your public your email address straight up into your DNS record, so it's public for the world to see. And then it sends you like XML files, and it's not very helpful. Unless that's your job, you know. So this basically grabs all those XML files, turns it into a weekly email, and then sends it out to you. One of the things I did find out when I set it up for mine is that, you know, I had all these emails coming from this server that I had no idea who it was. Upon a little bit more investigation, it was actually the email lists from SMB IT Pro. So because they're getting routed through another email server and not going directly through Office 365. And it looks like it's coming from me. It's alerted me of that and said, hey, there's 20 emails here that have come from this thing from you. You should be aware of that. So it took me a little bit of chasing up because it didn't actually say where it had come from. It just gave me a server address, basically, a host name. It's been good. So it'll be an interesting one, particularly for people that have been in business for a long time. See how many people are using their domains, and then once you've identified that, going and doing the extra steps of, you know, like you're always preaching, Robert, putting in that hard fail on the SPF record.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, we're seeing a need to lift the security game in a lot of cases. We need to look at as a, you know, lock everything down and then open things up as required rather than the opposite way around. Because there's just so many vulnerabilities. So a much smaller, surface area is going to make a big difference. So very simple thing to do. One of the tips that I give people is one of the most common things that people fail to do is with their Office 365 and Exchange mailboxes, they don't appreciate that not only can you get to it with your Outlook, but you can also get to it with POP3 and IMAP by default. So most people no longer use POP3 and IMAP to get access to their mailboxes, so you should go through and turn that off, and you should do so using a PowerShell script to make that nice and easy across your environment. So simple things like that can reduce your surface area and therefore improve your security and lower your risk, which is exactly what we want in this day and age.
Yeah, and things like that, they don't impact the customer experience at all, which is a great segue to our next thing. So maybe I'll let you do the introduction, Robert.
So probably what we need to do before we throw over to your initial interview here is just let people know how they can get in contact with us. So again, you'll find us at N2K Podcast on Twitter and on Facebook. You can send email to feedback@needtoknow.cloud. Again, the website for all the podcasts is podcast.needtoknow.cloud. Mr. Brenton over there is on the Twitter at Contact Brenton, and I'm at Director CIA. All these notes will be up on my blog once we are done, and we're looking forward to Brenton's first interview here, and it looks as though it's going to be a good one here. I think we're going to spend some time talking about the customer experience, which is obviously very, very important, and we've also got Josh Pell here, who's a good expert, it would seem, just reading this quickly, on what can be provided. So why don't we head over and get into that interview now.
G'day, dear listeners. Good to have you back. Today, we're going to be talking about customer experience, and I've got Josh Pell here today, which I'll tell you about in a little bit. But I want to start by telling you a story that explains customer experience pretty well. A few years ago, Houston Airport had this problem where all the people were sitting, were getting angry and putting in complaints because it took too long for the baggages to come off the planes so they could pick it up. The average wait was about 12 minutes. So best in class in the world was like 7.5, 8 minutes. So they employed extra baggage handlers, they worked harder, they provided better customer service, but they still got the same amount of complaints. So when they actually went out there, with the customers and figured out why they're angry, they figured out that it's because they were waiting around for 6 minutes for their bags to come out. It seemed like a long time. So what they did is they moved the baggage so it got unloaded at the other end of the airport. So they were walking for that 6 minutes and complaints evaporated overnight. So today we're talking about customer experience. I thought that was a good way of framing it, but I'm going to quickly introduce Josh and then get his take on customer experience versus customer service. So for starters, Josh is the head of project and solution delivery at Bendigo Telco. As well as being highly passionate solution driven IT project management professional, PMO professional, he has over 18 years of providing fantastic experiences to his customers, both internal and external, across a multitude of industries. Now, one of those industries was marketing. I was born from marketing and I moved into IT. So that's why everything I talk about on the podcast with Robert, I don't really sound like an IT person. I hang out with IT people, but I seem a bit odd or a bit off to some IT people. That's why, because I'm primarily marketing. Josh has had a marketing background as well. So he looks at IT in a very similar way to I do. So welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks, Brenton. Pleasure to be on with you. Looking forward to having a bit of a chat.
Yeah, don't be too nervous. It's pretty easy going. So let's get started. I'm going to ask you the first question. So what is customer experience? What do we mean when we talk about customer experience? How is that different to customer service?
I love this question. And you know, when we were discussing this before recording the cast, we've got slightly different interpretations on this, and I really like that we can discuss this. So to our listeners, you know, this is a personal take on it, but what I really want to share is, I guess, going through that whole value chain. So to me, customer service is a transactional piece of, it's one part of the customer experience journey. So your customer service might be a transaction. So take a retail store, for example. When we go onto the sales floor and ask where's that saucepan or where's that pair of socks or what have you, we're asking someone on the floor, on the sales floor, they've provided good customer service for that transaction. You then go to the registers. Hi, how are you? Do you have a Flybuys card or Woolworths card? Or I'll try and be brand agnostic. That's another element of customer service, or another transaction of customer service. Where I see customer experience, it's about the sum of the journey and collating those transactions. How was your whole experience in that store? How was it presented? Were the staff friendly the whole time? Did you find what you were looking for? Were you satisfied with the product you got? Would you buy another item from that store? And that's how I see it. And I'd be interested on your take in that, Brenton.
Yeah, look, I think you've hit it on the head there, Josh. It's one part of your customer experience. You can offer really great customer service and have a terrible customer experience. That is something that can happen. Like you said, if you go in there and the staff are really helpful, but they don't have the items that they said they had in stock, they're being misrepresenting you, or it's just too hard to work with them. It doesn't matter if they have the world's best customer service. We're not going to really be interested in coming back. So for me, customer experiences are about a feeling. So if how does the customer feel when they transact or deal with your company? Whereas customer service is the things that you do to service your customer. And the better you do those things, the happier the customer should become. But again, like you said, it's only one part of the puzzle.
Awesome. And it's interesting, you know, I conducted a quick straw poll today on, net promoter scores and a few things that we'll talk about a little bit later, and some of the different interpretations that we got just simply in the room of my current workplace. So, you know, customer experience and customer service do mean different things to different people, but I think on the whole of it, it's about that customer feel good, as you mentioned.
Yeah, couldn't agree more there, Josh. So let's keep moving because we've only got a short amount of time. We're at 5.5 minutes already. So
yeah, tick tock.
So how does customer experience apply to a service business like managed service provider? A lot of our listeners are managed service providers, and they, you used to work for one, you know that a lot of the stuff that you get given from vendors, you can't really change the customer experience of a lot of it. You know, Microsoft is how it is. If the customer doesn't like Outlook, most customers like Outlook, but if the customer doesn't like Outlook, there's not a lot you can do. So how can you improve the customer experience as a service business?
Oh, those troublesome Mac users. I didn't mean that, guys. So I guess putting it into that IT services or MSP layer, what we could have a look at is our engagements. And so what are our engagements like across the business? So, we all talk to the customer, not just sales. So the importance of manners and how we present ourselves to the customer, doesn't matter who we are, is so vital. I'm a really big stickler on making sure that the whole of business is across what we're talking to our customers about. So do we have a new sales lead for this customer for X widget? So that everyone's aware that, you know, this could be a very big opportunity for the business. So make sure that your help desk people are really excited to be talking to that customer. And even if it's not through a big opportunity that's current, there might be one coming. We don't know yet. So we should always be treating our customers like there's a big opportunity. And make sure that we're not just hocking widgets.
Yeah. So, that's a classic box sell, license sell, right? So you go in there, you go, customer needs security, so we'll sell them Microsoft Office 365 with EOP over the top of it, and we'll sell them some Webroot or whatever antivirus, and we'll put an RMM agent on, and we're a great service provider. Is that providing a great customer experience for the customer? Really depends on the customer, doesn't it? But there's ways that you can improve that service delivery.
Absolutely. And to go on with that, it was great that we threw all those products and licenses at the customer, but did the customer actually understand what we were talking about? Mm. Do they actually know what they've got? Do they actually understand the value proposition that you just put to them? Or did they just sign off because they were hoodwinked, confused, scared, particularly in a cybersecurity risk world that we are currently preside in? A lot of customers we're talking to aren't necessarily informed about cybersecurity, but they know they need a cybersecurity. And the fact I just said a cybersecurity should tell everyone that's the type of customer we could all be looking at. So we really need to make sure that we're talking to everyone in our audience, all of our customers, not just our CIOs or IT managers. We're talking to our finance managers. We're talking to our sales manager, our advocate, or our introduction into the door of that business could be anyone.
Yeah, and look, I think thinking cybersecurity is a really good one, because there's heaps of ways to sell cybersecurity, and a lot of people sell it on fear. So you go in and say, everybody in China, everybody in Russia has nothing better to do than hack your tiny little business. To mitigate that risk, what we do is we put in these security things. Now, that process of explaining cybersecurity to the customer and taking him on that journey from not being cyber aware to being more cyber aware and then putting in the mitigation steps, you know, are they panicked and worried about the whole process and unsure about things because that's how you've presented cybersecurity to them? Or is it, hey, look, we've identified there's some gaps. What we're going to do is we're going to make sure we're there for you if anything happens. And then we're going to put in those solutions that you need to over a period of time to bring you up to a specification where you can be comfortable. I think that's the sort of question we've got to ask ourselves as MSPs. Would you agree with that, Josh?
I would agree. And the other big piece is we've got to remember that our end customer is not likely as interested in innovation and new tech and IoT and all these great concepts. So we need to remember that because they're not that interested, we need to be able to convey their business problem, and we need to be able to also convey our solution in an easy to understand form. So is our customer, they might not even understand their own problem yet. Mm. They've come to you going, my computers don't work. Yep. Now that could be a virus. It could just simply be that the fleet of PCs that they've had at their disposal is now 20 years old. I've seen it firsthand. It's often that. So there's different scenarios at play. So
yeah, and don't jump in on there, Josh, because it reminds me of a story you told me from Bendigo Telco. This is where Josh works. And this company was having all of these problems and spending a lot of money, a huge amount of money with MSP on support. And they got Bendigo Telco in to come in and put a proper network solution in for them. And their support tickets just about disappeared overnight because they didn't have the problems all the time with the network because they had the best stuff and they'd been sold the best stuff and they'd gone through that process. And they couldn't be happier with the work that Bendigo Telco did. Can you just give us a bit more background on that one?
Other than the obvious product placement that's been inserted into this discussion. But I guess without going into the specifics of the customer, they were experiencing a number of challenges. And where we got to in the discussion is that as we were going through a bit of a needs analysis and trying to understand the actual root cause of the problem that they were experiencing, you know, they'd gone and bought U-Boot computers and cloud infrastructure and none of it was, it still wasn't delivering the speed. So the speed was the key word. It turns out it was the speed of the internet connectivity and the ability for the sites to talk to each other. Yet the solution that the previous provider had given them, or sorry, previous IT integrator, I should say, had provided them was up-spec'd computers and up-spec'd cloud infrastructure. That still wasn't going to obviously solve the business problem that that particular customer had. But actually just spending a bit of time and understanding and starting to decode what that customer's telling you, we got a solution out of it and we rolled in a network. Now, it happened to be obviously something, a solution we could provide. Mm. But in terms of the IT support as well, we've got channel partners. So we were able to reach out and engage and make sure that customer had a great relationship with not only us, but our channel partner in the IT integration space. And that's led to a massive saving in time and cost for that customer. And it was simply a little bit of listening. We didn't sell new innovative over the top solutions or anything like that. We just simply listened to the customer, and when they said they want more speed, we just went and tried to define what speed was to them. Yeah, that's a great example. I really love talking about it, so I'm glad you raised that, Brendan.
Yeah, yeah, because I think that's a really good one. I think going back to customer experience and linking this back in to keep it relevant is, if you follow some of these lean philosophies and you go in and you do your five whys philosophy, you do your root cause analysis, and you listen to the customer and go, okay, what is the problem that I'm solving for the customer? And am I best suited to solve this problem? And when those things really align, then you become with really happy customers who can't help but tell everybody they know about the work that you do. And that isn't really even a recent story, but it still sticks in my mind as one that, you know, I'll tell to people about how you can elevate your customer experience by not really doing a great deal. Like, you didn't have to reinvent the wheel or do anything crazy. It was just simple, basic, back to basics business stuff, really.
Yeah, and it comes down to, Brenton, I guess that the customer may not always be right, but they're not very often wrong. You know, they just don't know how to talk to you.
Yeah,
they're often scared of you. Particularly in our space of digital and information technology, a lot of our customers are still catching up,
yep.
and they don't know what they don't know. So it's up to you to try and help them, coach them, support them, guide them. And I think that that's very important to make sure it's, I guess, less about the widget and more about the comfort and the trust that the customer's getting there.
Yeah. That's really key. We've got to keep moving, but I think that point on trust was really quite pertinent, because that's what you're trying to build in this service industry game. It's all trust, it's all customer experience. So I'm interested in your takes on who are the masters of customer experience in your mind? Like, who do you see out there that do it really well? And maybe have you got an example of someone who doesn't do it as well?
Oh, look, other than Brenton Johnson at Uptake Digital.
No, the flattery will get you everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think we all have some really good examples of some great experiences. And there's a couple that we're going to discuss. One for me is the Iconic. I love the Iconic. They know what I want before I know what I want. They have seen all of my purchasing. They know what size I am. They get that size and they match it against the other brands to make sure that's the one size across Iconic. Stuff like that is brilliant. Now, that's a website, so I'm not even talking to anyone, yet I have a level of trust there that I'll log on and I'm going to get good quality fashionable clothes and shoes and what have you that are going to fit me. Because the Iconic said it's going to fit me. And when I get them often, so my wife probably thinks too often, Afterpay certainly very happy with me, they fit every time. That's the experience we're looking for. That whole journey that I've had, they keep tapping me with, you know, obviously it's to sell product, but they tap me with the stuff that I've expressed interest in before. You know, you keep your wish list, but they say, you've bought from this brand before, would you like this? And it's just this great experience that I'm able to have. I'd be interested on your take, Brent.
Oh, well, to be fair, like, the Iconic spent over $100 million on their website. So if you're sitting there wondering, how do you spend $100 million on your website and not waste it? The Iconic is probably one of the best examples of that. It's well regarded as one of the gold standards in getting that, what's now sort of trademarked as Amazon experience. Like, everyone talks about the Amazon experience, but I think there's a lot of organizations that do it a lot better than even Amazon do. So being an Audible customer and having to deal with the changeover from US to AU not being very smooth, and, you know, again, they just didn't transfer my account, so I was in half land, and, you know, I'm like, this is the Amazon experience everyone talks about, you know. But anyway, did you have another example there of a, you know, a really solid customer experience that you can remember?
Yes, and Brenton, you and I agree on this one. Unfortunately, where I live at the moment is not within their delivery area, so it could be seen as a negative experience, but from when I was inside the delivery area, it was certainly a very positive experience for me. It was Domino's. You know, and again, it's another online presence, but it was one where, you know, when you're going for delivery, fast food, you don't necessarily want that human interaction. You know, the best use case, and this could be rather embarrassing, Friday night, I'm in my tracky pants and t-shirt and slippers, and I'm at home. I don't want to go anywhere. Probably don't want to talk to anyone. Domino's, I'm able to have that whole experience and customize what I want, get it to my door in a fixed time frame at fixed price. And I know you've got strong opinions on this, Brent, and I'd love to hear your take.
I remember when I was first got my iPhone 4. This is how long it was, you know, we're iPhone X or whatever now, 10. And I'm sitting there, and about the only thing that was useful to do on it was to play Angry Birds and order pizzas. but the pizza, like, I'm sitting there, and people are going, well, how do we do online? We're confused because we didn't know if Facebook was going to be a thing forever at that stage. Like, you know, people were still using Foursquare. It was like a really early time in digital marketing land. And people were like, you know, how do I do digital marketing? How do I do customer experience? And Dad went and studied at, he did internet communications for 3 years at Curtin University. And he says, just order a pizza. You know, you'll become an expert. Just order a pizza and Domino's on your iPhone, you know. Because that's how good the experience was. And they've kept that customer experience. They remember what you order. It's like the iconic. They have a memory. They go, okay, you like the vegetarian pizza. They send you specials relevant to who you are and where your area are, you know. People don't mind getting communication from people who they love. That's what the great customer experience gives you.
Absolutely. Now, we've been very excited to talk about who hasn't got this right, because it's contentious. Do we want to name and shame?
Well, I don't know. Like, I think we're going to avoid naming and shaming IT vendors, although there's quite a few that struggle in this space. But Josh did have a recent experience with a retailer, which I thought summed up, you know, they could have excellent customer experience, very solid business, great systems. But unfortunately, they've made a few mistakes, which has now impacted on your customer experience and now is going out to thousands of people around the world through this podcast. So off you go.
I'm open to change my opinion for a free pair of runners. no, I kid, listeners.
I can't be bought for one pair of runners.
No.
Send two.
I guess, now, I am a major advocate for this brand outside of this. So I have always been a customer, and it's because of the sum of the transactions I've had a great experience. But the sum of transactions lately has equaled a negative experience, and that's Rebel Sport. So recently there was a fairly big shoe sale on at Rebel Sport that I got an email for, and absolutely I'd be interested. I needed some new runners, and I needed a new pair of cross trainers. I'd burn through my runners and cross trainers very quickly, so the ability to bulk buy at 50% off was very appealing. So I went into the store because I thought I'd like to try a few on. There was no signage in the store. There was nothing on the email to say it was online only. But I had to ask, and it was online only. So I was in the store, could see the shoe that I wanted, but it was online only. So I couldn't get the online price in store. I had to go back home.
And that's a great customer service experience. Someone comes in, goes, I want that shoe. And, you know, you said you'll price match. Can you price match with your own online store? Like, you know?
I've never seen someone cannibalize their own book quite like that. however, this gets, I guess, better or worse, depending on your outlook in life, Brenton. But you know, as a lot of our listeners would be, very busy people, and we've got a lot on, and we try and pack as much into our weekends as possible. So the sale ended midnight Sunday night or Monday morning, and so I jumped on at 11 p.m. Sunday night to log online and grab my shoes. The sale was taken down. It was taken down, Brenton. It was supposed to finish at midnight. And at 11 p.m., I've gone on and they're not there. That's an awful experience. And because for me, I didn't get what I was told in my email. So I was very excited, wanted to buy, and now I've been denied twice through two channels to this particular retailer. I've been denied. So I bought my shoes from Iconic.
And like, you know, you've put all that effort in, you've decided what shoe you're going to buy, you're ready to buy, you're ready to transact. The sale was a hook to get you interested. Oh yeah, I probably should go buy new shoes. It makes sense to buy them while they're on sale, etc., etc. But it's come back and it has not ended favorably. So
no, and I guess, Brenton, a quote that you like to use often is that 60% of customers have already done their research prior to trying to buy.
That's right. Yeah. So. You were pre-sold, so you went on, you went, found the shoe that you wanted, learnt about the shoe, learned about the brand. By the time the salesperson saw you, you knew what shoe you wanted, you know. And this is another thing, I suppose we're getting a bit off track, but when customers are coming to your business, trust me, they've already researched everything they possibly can about you before they call. They don't want to ring up and have an awkward conversation and say, so what does your business do? The only reason people are having conversations like that in 2018 is because their website is lousy. It's either in language the customer doesn't understand. Now, I'm getting on my soapbox here, right?
Yes, but I can literally see him standing on the box right now.
Yeah, so either it's in customer language they don't understand, the information's not there, it's hard to access, you know, it's not in a format they can read on their phone. It's just simple 101 stuff about communicating with customers, but people are still making that mistake over and over and over and over again, and it's killer.
Exactly. So if that customer can't find your front door, how can you have a great engagement or conversation with them? So you might be that champion customer service business or person, but if they can't find you, you can't have that conversation.
You could be best in the world, but I can guarantee you, as far as a customer wants to do, they don't want to sit there and learn about your business. And I think the best example, I'm going to reference my old man again, Chris Johnson, he really nailed this when he was saying, you know, when you go out and buy a car these days, people go in and know more about the car than the car salesman knows about it. And I was talking to the car dealer, the Audi car dealer recently, and she was saying, we have customers who spend their whole life obsessing about buying an Audi, and they come in and ask us all the questions that they know the answers to because they want the experience, right? And they did a whole thing on customer experience training, which I did attend. And it was just, I was like, yeah, okay, these guys really get it. Like, they just 100% get it. That as soon as the customer walks through the door is when the dealership gets them. You could not have a happier time in your life. They make it as good as you could possibly ever have it. But all their marketing on the front end is all really tight. If you want to learn about this car, there's communities, there's everything you need to really love and get obsessed about it before you can even afford to buy one, which is, that's nailing it, in my opinion. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, Brenton. And obviously, again, you covered before around the Iconics website spend. I can only imagine what Audi's is. But, but I guess the overarching theme that we can take from that is that they've built a destination brand and then they have a great conversation with their customer once they've got them in the door.
Yeah. Well, no one goes in and goes, I need a car. No one walks into Ferrari and says, I need a car. No one walks into BMW and says, I'm in the market for a car, right? Now, if you're getting people coming through your business going, I need an IT, you've got some work to do, I think. Quite a bit of work to do. And even though customers, yes, they don't know much about technology, I don't think it's good enough to sit back and say, yeah, well, it's too hard to educate them because they're the ones spending the money. They need to know what they're spending their money on and why, and be ahead of the curve on that one. And we're getting on a tangent, so I'm going to have to keep pushing on, right? So how do we measure customer experience in IT, Josh? This is one that I do quite a bit of, but I'd be interested in your take on measuring this stuff.
Well, Brenton, I know, and I'm going to assume some of our listeners know, but I'll certainly educate them that Brenton's very big on his data and his analytics. So, Brenton, you'll probably have some more score-based methods as compared to myself. What I like to do is a big one I was taught in marketing, which is step outside the box, or AKA your business, and be the customer. How hard is it to deal with you? You know, how hard is your business to deal with as a customer? Is there too many call routes between help desk and getting a senior engineer? To get to a sales guy, is it easier to call the mobile than the 1-800 dedicated sales line? All those sort of things, that's what I look at as measurement of, you know, that customer experience.
So what we call it now is customer journey mapping, but you were doing it before it was called that.
Apparently so. Yeah. So Look, it's just very simple, very basic. So often we get caught up in a lot of jargon, but essentially step outside the box, pretend to be your customer. How hard is it to deal with you? And if you find that hard, imagine how hard your customers are feeling it, because they are nowhere near as educated on your business process as you are. Now, even if there is no business process, you at least still know where to go to get things done. The customer doesn't. So if you found it hard, the customer's going to find it double, triple, quadruply as difficult.
Yeah, and I think, no, I don't want to rip on Microsoft, because this is a Microsoft podcast and we're very, very favorable of what Microsoft's doing. But I was sitting in a right thing, and they had a licensing expert who spent 20 years of his life doing Microsoft licensing. That's all he did for 20 years. And he was a foremost expert on Microsoft licensing. And someone put their hand up and said, hey, look, here's the situation I'm in. I'm not sure if I'm licensed properly. What do you think? And he goes, oh, actually, that's not the part of licensing I do. I need to refer you to a colleague who does that part of licensing, right? So how hard is it to purchase your product? If someone could come out with a comparable product to Microsoft, and I can't see anything happening in the foreseeable future, and they said, it's this much per this, and you go, okay, well, how much is it for this? Just multiply. It's just one number, you know? SAP's, you know, they're moving towards putting pricing on their website because a customer wants pricing on the website. But the way they price things is insane. It's a 5-page document that they've been able to condense it down to of how you might be able to price up your own SAP before you even get consultants in. So people go, okay, is this a $100 million project, a $250 million project? I just want a ballpark estimation of where we're at. So if you're walking in with a 7-page service catalog with a whole bunch of jargon on it and product codes and stuff, and you think you're a really professional MSP because you've got that, take a step back, get out of the box, as you said, and imagine you're the customer and you're sitting there going, you know, why is there 6 hourly rates? Like, and how do I know when I ring which hourly rate I'm getting charged? And when the account managers come in and you're billing me all hourly and there's 2 of them walk in, I'm not really comfortable with that. I'm happy with just one. I'm happy with no meetings, actually. Don't call me. Well, I don't want to spend money. I don't see the value.
And I guess, Brenton, that's your take, is that, you know, you don't really want those sales guys from a touch point perspective that often.
Not if you're paying them hourly, right? You know, there's nothing worse when you get a lawyer and you go, okay, well, I need a lawyer to help understand my legal issue, and 2 of them walk in and then they're the 2 names that are on the door. And you're like, oh, how much is this costing me, rather than how am I solving the problem?
I can certainly attest to the, I guess, some of the troubles that we can have in the Microsoft cloud. And as you know, Brenton, and a lot of others that would know me, I'm a major Microsoft advocate and think that they solve quite a lot of business problem, but we're still missing some of the basics in some of the transactions that actually impact the overall experience. You know, at the moment we're working with a customer on in Microsoft Azure that they've changed their billing from credit card to invoice. They want to change it back.
Oh.
They cannot.
Doesn't work like that.
You've got to migrate.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that's an example of somewhere that transaction is really not good. And the sum of the transactions is the experience to me. So I'm looking at that transaction and I'm starting to doubt my experience in Azure. That's not good.
Mm. Yeah, and I think when we're talking about things that really impact the customer experience, I think nothing really impacts it more than when you get billing and pricing wrong. If you charge the customer more than what they think they should be charged, you send out an invoice and it seems unreasonable and they get bill shock from that, they'll remember that for the rest of their lives and they'll forever scrutinize your invoices, even if they don't tell you that they're doing it, even though you don't think they're doing it. You've got to be extremely careful around pricing. And what other things would you say you've got to be really careful about?
Is the customer at the center of the decisions that you're making in your business?
Mm.
That's a big one for me. Yeah. You know, we all talk about customer centricity and the customer's, Got to be part of the journey every step of the way, but really, are your business decisions actually customer driven? So the new products and services that you're looking at, just because they're cool doesn't mean anyone's going to buy them. Just because they're innovative and disruptive and surfacing information through a single pane of glass and all that other jargon that goes on, is the customer actually going to buy any of that? Do they need any of that? Does it bring value to them? So if your products and services aren't hitting the mark with your customers, you're not providing good experience to them. Every time you transact with them in your quarterly reviews or monthly reviews or help desk conversations, when you're bringing these new products in, are they actually relevant to that customer?
Yeah, and I think that's the hardest thing to get right, to be honest. When all the stuff that we're talking about, a lot of this stuff, there's easy levers you can move to make your customer experience better or worse. But when we're getting down to voice of the customer, that's a very, very difficult thing to do. So I do a bit of consulting. And when you go in and do consulting, and Josh has done consulting as well, you can go in and you can identify pretty much all the business problems almost instantly, right? Because you're an external third party and you don't think like they do. And you go, okay, well, I know why this is the case and I know what this is the case, but now we've got to do a 100-hour engagement to educate the customer on why that's the case so they don't think we just come up with this off the top of our heads. And 100 hours, the results look almost identical, but, you know, you've brought the customer along on that journey because they're just like, you know, I don't get it.
And the customer's got to see value in that 100-hour engagement as well, because you know our customers are busy just like we are. We're all working in our day jobs. They're trying to make their business successful. We're trying to make our business successful. The reason we're in the IT space is to not only play with cool widgets and gadgets, it's also to make other businesses successful. So if we're not doing that and we're disrupting them by spending a lot of time with them and not adding value, they'll get someone in who does.
Yeah, and like some of the stuff that like you guys can do without really thinking, getting your customers into a room and saying, you know, what really grinds your gears? You know, what really pisses you off? It can be very difficult to get real honest feedback from the customer because they're trying to have a relationship with you. They like you. They think you're a good guy. You're doing all these great things. And they think if they piss you off, you might not answer the call when they need you, right? So to get some really hard, honest feedback back on how you're doing as a business is really, really difficult. So going back to how we measure this stuff, you know, like I run Net Promoter Score, which is a single question that you send out that says how likely are you to recommend this business to your friends and colleagues. All that does is measure your word of mouth. How are people referring you, right? So I run that and I'm up around 90 on that, right? I do customer satisfaction scores, which should be about, you know, 90 plus, 95 plus. And that's basically every time I close the ticket in Zendesk, it comes up, sends an email to the customer and says it with three smiley faces and you pick the smiley face that you like, hopefully the green one, and then you can add a little comment about, you know, how did you find the experience and whatever. And, you know, if they've had a great experience, they'll usually leave a comment. If it's just a, you know, everyday experience, oh, I need a password reset, oh, you reset it within the hour, I'm really happy with that. But they're not going to write an essay about that. But, you know, I had a customer who was caught up with Melbourne IT, his wife's business actually, and, you know, he's getting all this flack at home because of email and this and that and couldn't get any of it to work. And I jumped in there and said, oh, this is easy. Fixed it in about half an hour. It's a bit longer than that, but because I had to deal with the other Melbourne IT. But at the end of it, she's over with us. We take care of the whole experience for her. She doesn't have to worry. He's happy to pay almost unlimited money for that because now he can go home and spend time with his wife. Quality time, not, oh, yeah, I'll get to that, honey. he just palmed it off to us and we took care of it. So, you know, typically not a customer we'd go out of our way to acquire, but because we had a really good customer there that had a problem and that was impacting his life, we're like, no, we'll take care of all of that for you. You've got to know we're here for you no matter what.
Well, it's the sum of the transactions, Brenton. So it's another piece of customer service that you've done that's given your actual customer another positive whole experience with you. So yeah,
that feeling, right?
That absolute feeling of, I trust this guy, which is very difficult to get. And once you've got, hang on.
Yeah.
Keep it. You know, and speaking on that trust, another, I guess, way that I like to measure customer experience, and it's one I learned back in my banking days, which was, are you top of wallet? So I guess to define that a little bit further is, you know, are you first choice? So in technology conversations our customers are having, is your business first choice? Are you top of wallet? Are you the one that's always pulled out and used for transactions?
I love that discussion too, Josh, because we run around, we talk about shadow IT with our mid-market customers, right? And we go, you know, shadow IT, people are running around with Dropbox. Most of the time, 30, 40% of the workforce is using Dropbox and IT doesn't know about it, right? And you've tried to put people into a SharePoint, OneDrive environment. Maybe you've done that well, maybe you haven't, but people are still using Dropbox, so they don't want to move across. You know, this is a challenge. This is a challenge we're all facing. So you go, okay, well, how do we make OneDrive, SharePoint the vendor of choice? How do we make, you know, Uptake Digital the vendor of choice? So instead of going to Dropbox to solve their problems, they come to us and go, hey, look, we've got some files I need on my mobile. I need them here. The moment we're emailing it to ourselves to get it in.
Such a common move.
Problem, right? So we've got 100 gigabyte mailboxes because it's got all these attachments in it. So, you know, how do I solve that problem? I'll go, it's really quite simple. You move it into OneDrive, you move it into SharePoint, you put in a plan to move, you know, some of this business documents into SharePoint, and all of a sudden, you're the vendor of choice. And then once you've got the customer and they're coming to you, then you can control the experience that they have for the OneDrive SharePoint rollout. They try and do it themselves, they'll end up back in Dropbox because it's not something they can do with it by themselves. It seems easy enough, right?
Exactly.
You have OneDrive, you have SharePoint, you put documents in it, files and folders, right? Isn't that how it works?
Well,
Robert's going to kill me.
So are so many other SharePoint developers right now. But you're right, Brenton. It's that it should be easy. But what's holding that customer, or at least a percentage of that customer, back from that? So if you're top of wallet or your first choice, they're going to hopefully be asking you, oh, we've also got this little Dropbox that the finance team run that we forgot earlier in our discussions. Would you be able to help our finance team out? Or the sharing of like attachments on emails is, that would have to be one of my biggest gripes going around, is that, you know, we've got SharePoint or we've got Google Docs. Doesn't matter, it's a Ford versus Holden argument there. I prefer the SharePoint solution, but that's just me. You know, we've got these solutions in place for doc control. Why are we sending attachments? Well, it might turn out that someone's not got permissions to contribute or even read that
document.
Well,
no one's being taught, right? So they're sitting there going, well, you know, HR says I've got to, or IT says now I've got to put it in SharePoint. I put it in the wrong thing once and got in trouble, and I had a really bad experience that time. I don't want to do that anymore. So all of a sudden, you're back to the old days where you have 10 or 15 versions of a document and no one knows what the right version is, right? And everyone's versioning things with V1-4-5.
Or yeah, whatever versioning you take. And I guess that's a quality piece. So it's the quality of the experience and the quality of conversation that you're having.
Yeah.
You know, why are these people doing this? Have you had a really good conversation with that whole of business? And are you their trusted partner? And partner is the key word. Are you their technology partner and not just their vendor?
Be partner of choice, I should say.
Partner of choice.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, we're at around 43 minutes now. So with Robert and I banging on in the first half that we haven't recorded yet, this could run into a pretty long podcast. So what I want to do is wind it up with a couple of key bits of wisdom. So I'm an MSP. I want to get started in this space. I want to do better. What are the couple of bits of advice you can give us that will point us in the right direction?
Good question, Brenton. And certainly when we discussed this earlier, it was, what was your number one tip? And I came back with two, so you had to reframe the question.
Yeah,
but
I had to redo it.
Typical project manager adjusting scope.
Scope, or
when I can adjust the scope just for some fun.
43 minutes, Josh.
Time cost scope. So my tips are under promise and over deliver. It's the importance of managing the expectations of your customer is so vital. If you say you're going to do something in 4 weeks, do it in four, or even better, do it in three.
Exactly.
Don't do it in eight. You have broken the contract with your customer, likely the written one you put together, but also that handshake that you had with the customer, that moment where you both connected and said, let's trust each other, is gone.
Yeah, are they going to call you back when they've got 4 weeks still project again? When it's end of financial year and they've got to get it in before whatever happens?
No, you failed to deliver and they may not call you again, ever. So, you know, and I've been there. I live it now as a project manager. You know, you live that.
Yeah, the sales guys run off and sell stuff and then you've got to figure out how to deliver it, right? Isn't that how project management works?
Oh, look, not at Bendigo Telco. Our guys are all good. No, look, it can happen. And it's basically just, it's well-intentioned conversation that ends up becoming project delivery.
Yeah.
And you really got to get through there and set that expectation or reset that expectation if you've had a errant conversation to build a relationship and you're doing something slightly outside of what your box is.
Yeah, or you're halfway through a project, something happens, you know, your biggest client gets a big cyber attack and you've got to put all your resources on that. You come back after that cyber attack and go, here's what happened. I hope you understand it's, you know, it's our failure to have, you know, that, but sometimes things just happen, right?
Yep, it's a bit of transparency with your expectation management, and I think that's so important. And I mean, I'm probably preaching to the converted as far as our listeners, but I think it's just an important tip anyway. And my other tip is track everything. No detail is too small. So some of the examples is, you know, birthdays, wedding anniversaries, start of the school year, if your customers have got kids going off to prep and things like that, other business critical dates that are critical to that customer of yours. Note everything of your conversation. Now, that doesn't have to be a CRM. It could be OneNote, it could be Notepad, could be in Excel. I don't know how people might track their various customer conversation. Hopefully a bit more organized than a spreadsheet, but that's up to the user, I guess. But track everything. It's so important to track even the most minor component, because what we're looking at there is you're picking up intel on the customer. And that intel is going to be so valuable in building that trust relationship. What do you think, Brenton?
Oh, look, I couldn't agree more. Know your customer. I remember when I used to work at McDonald's, which basically gave me a business degree back when I was young. I still haven't found anything in business that's taught me more about how to run a very well-run business than McDonald's. And one of their key things was NYK, know your customer. It means a different thing in the banking world.
Yeah, very different thing, Brenton.
Yeah, we won't touch on the Royal Commission, but, you know your customer is, you know, how well do you know your customer? And the better you know your customer, the better you can serve your customer. And that's what it is at the end of the day. So great tips. I'm going to close this off because we're hitting on nearly 50 minutes, Josh. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Been a pleasure, Brenton.
If we want to get in contact with you, if we want to follow you, or how do we get in touch with Josh Pell?
No worries. So I am on LinkedIn and Twitter. LinkedIn's probably the more active one in terms of seeing what I like and what I can contribute out. So LinkedIn, look up Josh Pell, Head of Project and Solution Delivery, Bendigo Telco.
Yeah, don't get him confused with George Pell. That's a different, not related.
I have no comment on the Cardinal, but yeah, be more than happy if anyone wants to reach out and ask any questions or anything of that nature. I strongly believe in collaborating, so I look forward to collaborating with some of you guys.
Yeah, of course. And if you can't find him, send me a message. You just Google me, as you would have already heard, because Robert and I always do that thing. BrentonJohnson.com. Send me a message and I'll connect you guys up. So Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you in a couple of weeks.
Bye, guys.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.